up, y'all? Welcome to the Sports Medicine Broadcast, episode 100. We are finally here. We have finally reached 100 episodes. All right, and so we are joined by Dr. Candace Tunis, talking about scaphoid fractures of the wrist. A couple years back, she was at the Sports Medicine Update, and I really enjoyed hearing from her, so I was excited to hear from her and then actually get to interview her this time. So I'm actually doing the interview, but again, the first part of what you're hearing is her lecture at the 13th Annual Sports Medicine Update, thanks to Memorial Hermann and Bob Marley. So then the second part is the interview that me and Steven Ramirez do with Dr. Tunis right before she has to go to her breakout session and physically demonstrate how she evaluates the hand and those kind of things. And so good conversation, and I look forward to hopefully getting her back on the podcast. So again, Dr. Candace Tunis, she's a hand specialist. She's working out at Richmond Bone and Joint, which is a part of the Memorial Hermann team, but she'll talk more about that in her interview. So on the Sports Medicine Broadcast, we're looking for people to rate and review the podcast on iTunes so that it can help it move up the chart and help other people find it. So if you will, please rate and review the Sports Medicine Broadcast on iTunes. That way we can help others find it and improve the way that we do CEUs as athletic trainers. So for Jeremy and Bill and Dr. Yellen and Knobloch, thanks for listening to the Sports Medicine Broadcast.
Thank you guys so much for inviting me back. I was here 2 years ago and got an MA. I'm happy to come back. I'm now fully on the ground with my partner. I've got the irony that actually this afternoon I'm racing one of these. But I'm here to talk to you today about the scaphoid, just because it's a problematic injury. It's most common in young kids. I'm here to kind of explain some of the things about how I treat them, but also a little bit about why it's a problem and things that we can do maybe to catch more of these and get them treated a little bit more quickly. So it's a fairly common injury. I mean, right now I'm treating a handful of these problems this afternoon. Certainly a lot of them get sent to me, but it's a fairly common injury again in your young athlete. It's very easily missed. And that's part of that is because it's not always that significantly painful. We're limiting. A lot of these kids are able to play. Certainly they don't want to be taken out for the season, so they'll just kind of like keep going and keep going with it. Keep thinking, oh, it'll get better. And then the other issue with it is that these have a little hard time healing. This bone takes sometimes up to 4 to 5 months to heal. A long time. That's like an eternity in teenagers. If we don't treat them properly, they go on to a very predictable form of early arthritis, which, you know, 70 or 80 arthritis in the wrist, that's one thing to manage. If you're 25 or 30, that's a whole different. So these happen about 1.47 per 1,000 per year. Again, the highest rate is in the 10 to 19 year, junior high school athlete. So why do we care? Well, if we don't catch them and treat them quickly, and we miss an occult fracture, over 10% of those won't heal, and they'll tend to progress to carpal collapse and arthritis. And so what is carpal collapse? Well, basically, you have all these little bones in your wrist, they're all connected by fairly important ligaments. And if you disrupt part of that connection, either with a ligament injury here or with a fracture here in the scaphoid, then it's kind of like driving your car out of alignment. And then you'll go on to have a fairly predictable form of arthritis that starts here and then migrates over there until pretty much the whole wrist will be arthritic. This is just kind of what that looks like. Here's the scaphoid here. Here's a fracture in it in this direction, and if that fracture doesn't heal, then all of a sudden the linkage between these bones is disrupted. And you can see here's a relatively normal looking joint here with the space between the lunate and the radius. Over here, that space is gone. So here, this joint's worn out. Same thing over here, this joint's worn out. And then over time, this portion of the bone wall, a lot of times, will kind of just dissolve, and you'll get arthritis here, and then here in the mid-carpal joint as well. And really, once you get to this point, the only real way of treating this is with either a partial or a total wrist fusion, which is something that, 30-year-old doesn't really want to have to consider. So how do they typically present? It's usually when they fall into an outstretched hand, which can happen in a number of sports. They have radial or thumb-sided wrist pain. Sometimes it'll kind of improve to this sort of tolerable level after a week or two, but it oftentimes doesn't resolve. So if you see a kid who's kind of like, oh my sprained my wrist now in practice, kind of not getting better. These are the kids that a lot of times have one of these fractures that you might be missing. It happens again with this fall onto the hand. The scapula is a fairly vulnerable spot right here. And, in some cases, this type of injury will cause a distal radius fracture. But again, in this population, these young athletes, a lot of times it's the scapula that takes the brunt of the force for whatever reason and causes the fracture across it here. So again, it's a young athlete that gets these. The kids that I usually see with this are usually football or soccer players that are most common. Again, it's a sprain that never really got better. A lot of times they'll come in at the end of the season, sort of like just wait it out and try and splint it, tape it, whatnot, and then they come in, get a rush of these in December. After Thanksgiving, the things haven't really settled down. And at that point, unfortunately, after it's been a few weeks to a few months since it happened, it's at that point what's called a non-union, where it really is not showing any evidence of healing. So in my opinion, if you have radial or unsighted wrist pain in an athlete after a fall, that's a scapula fracture until you can really convince me that it's not. The scapula is situated here in this portion of the wrist. So, we talked about the anatomic snuff box that's created by sort of this soft spot between the tendons that work the thumb and the wrist as well. So they'll have pain or decreased motion of, sometimes it's more of a thumb pain too, a pain at the base of the thumb and also obviously wrist pain. They can have wrist pain or swelling, again, where the snuff box is. But sometimes the scapula is not even that tender and the exam is kind of unremarkable. So we don't really strictly classify these, but we do speak about these mainly in relation to where the fracture occurs and kind of the orientation of the fracture. And the reason that we care about that is because the location of the fracture is very relevant to how well these heal. Most of these are fractures that occur here in the sort of middle portion of the thumb, or the waist of the fracture. You can occasionally get a scapular tubercle fracture that's fairly uncommon, and then these dreaded proximal pole or proximal third fractures, and we'll talk about why those are a bit of an issue. So here's just, some examples of different fractures. They're going to come in lots of different varieties. Here's the tubercle here, and here's a fracture across the tubercle. Here's another kind of unusual looking tubercle fracture, but again, this is at the distal portion. You can actually feel the tubercle if you put the pressure right on the base of your thumb. We'll talk about this when we do a breakout session. It's a kind of projection that you can feel right just distal to your wrist flexion crease. That's really is where the scapular tubercle is. Again, here's some fractures here at the waist, and here's the bone here. Here's another waist fracture, and then here are some fractures at the proximal pole here. So this bone is covered almost completely with cartilage. It's bathed entirely in synovial fluid, which may be another contributing factor about why these don't heal that well. Has lots of different articular surfaces, articulates with the radius, the trapezium, trapezoid, the lunate, capitate. I mean, most of it is cartilage. Unfortunately, that's not. It's really this ridge, which is where the blood supply enters. So the blood supply, this is really the kind of crux about these fractures. And so it gets the blood supply from a branch off the radial artery, comes in here. There's a portion that comes in dorsally and a portion that kind of comes in volarly. And as you can kind of see here, the blood supply all kind of enters in the distal portion of the bone. The palmar or the volar blood supply enters in up here near the tubercle. Even the dorsal blood supply, again, on the distal half of the bone, it's got to trickle through that entire bone in order to heal something way on the other end. So again, this is the proximal side of the wrist. And so these are the fractures that really have an issue healing. And again, you can kind of see in this diagram, if this is distal and this is proximal, these ones out near the tubercle, that's no problem. They're going to heal fine. Even the waist fractures, I usually tell people that they're about an 85% healing rate. But if you start drifting here towards the proximal pole, those healing rates drop substantially, again, because you're separating that bone from the rest of the blood supply. So the other issue, so one issue is blood supply, another issue is just missing these fractures. And again, we talked about the symptoms can be pretty minimal. The other issue is that the x-rays can be kind of normal looking, or at least fairly subtle, and about up to 40% of these are missed initially. So you have to have a fairly high index of suspicion. you know, kid comes in after a fall during a game and have pain over here, that's again, it's a scapular fracture until I can convince myself that it's not. So I protect them initially as if there is a fracture. So, and there's some debate now about whether or not you really need to include the thumb. There's a fairly good study that just came out in our journal last month that randomized short arm splints and cast to thumb spicas, and there really wasn't any difference in healing. So I've actually stopped putting most of my skateboards with, you know, stopped including the thumb unless there's splints in my skateboards. But you'll see that a lot. So put them in a splint and protect them initially, and then reevaluate them. Check them again in about a week or two. See, you know, as the dust settles, if there's no pain and x-rays are still normal, they're fine. They're good to go. But if there's still soreness around there, even if the x-rays are normal, then I talk to them about getting an MRI. An alternative to this sort of splinting and protecting and waiting for 2 weeks is just go ahead and get an MRI. If they really want to know, do I have it or not, get the MRI. And I offer that to my kids. Because MRI is a whole lot more sensitive than x-rays. And again, it's a good alternative to this whole splint for 2 weeks and recheck. But again, if the exam is still concerning in 2 weeks, even if the x-rays look normal, I'll get an MRI at that point. The MRI, you know, here's a fairly clear-looking fracture on an x-ray. But, you know, here's a picture of the skateboard after an injury. There's not a whole lot going on, and it's looks fairly normal to me. Here's an MRI of that same case, and you can see, here's a dark line across here. There's the fracture on the MRI. The other thing is that in a different sequence of MRI, you know, the bone will normally look dark. Here's fluid in the bone, and here's another fracture. So how do we treat these? Well, there's some where it's very clear how you're going to treat them. If they're displaced, meaning that they're shifted more than a millimeter, you know, those get surgery. If they're proximal fractures, again, we talked about how much of an issue there is with healing of the proximal hole. If there's any fracture of that proximal third of the bone, I would recommend surgery for that too. If the fractures of the distal portion or the tubercle, the one that heals great no matter pretty much what you do, those all get casted. The question mark is in this sort of middle of the road. The non-displaced waist fracture, those are the ones where you can really kind of go either way. You can go cast or surgery. And ultimately, these are really up to the patient and the family. So why is there a debate about those? Well, the healing rates between casting and surgery for a non-displaced waist fracture are pretty much the same. So you're not going to change how well they're going to heal. Still about 85 to 90%, so it's good. The casting, if you're going to treat the cast, has to be started within 3 weeks of the injury. And again, we talked about a lot of times that's not when I'm getting these. I'm getting these like 2-3 months later. Casting, you're going to have to cast them for at least 8 to 12 weeks, sometimes longer. And the studies that have been done comparing the two, again, similar rates of healing, but they do show an earlier return to work or sport with surgery. As far as the downsides of surgery, you can have some issues with stiffness. You do have to open the capsule in the back of the wrist to fix the fracture. Stiffness, you know, there is a cutaneous fringe in the nerve that's in the area that can get injured as part of surgery. You know, infections are issues. I mean, those are all fairly uncommon, but, you know, certainly the risk of surgery. So there are a couple different ways and techniques, but you can do a percutaneous screw with a very tiny incision on the back of the wrist. That's really only feasible for truly non-displaced fractures. I usually use a small incision just so I can see it better. I think it's a little bit easier. I don't think it makes much of a difference. A small incision on the back of the wrist. This is just the different types of screws that you can see. I use this one in the middle. I mean, they're all designed basically to squeeze those two ends of the bone together in order to help it heal. I'll put them in a splint or a cast for about 6 weeks. And depending on their sport, depending on their position, you know, you can consider letting them play in that period of time protected. For me, it's really a case-by-case basis because if it's a fracture that I'm a little worried about it healing, you know, if it's a contact sport, you know, I may or may not be willing to let them do that. I usually put them in a cast, but I just kind of just throw everything, including the kitchen sink initially, so I don't have to do this once. I don't have to go back in and try and get it to heal later. So I usually protect them for 6 weeks. If the 6 weeks things are looking good, then I'll probably let them play protected. sometimes it's really hard to tell. You know, it's hard to tell if he's a fracture in the first place. It's hard to tell if that sucker's healing too. So in some cases, I'll use a CT scan if there's any kind of doubt about whether or not it's healing. And if the CT scan says that it's healing, they can stay unprotected, in my opinion. A lot of times too, I'll use a bone stimulator. Basically, there's some data to suggest that it certainly can help speed up healing, improve healing rates in some fractures. So especially if it's a proximal fracture, I'll give them a bone stimulator off the bat rather than, again, waiting until I don't see something happening to try to treat it later. So non-median is basically defined as you're not having any kind of healing. Technically, it's after 6 months, but if after a few months there's nothing going on, you're concerned that this is not healing. And so what happens if it doesn't heal? We talked about arthritis earlier, but the other problem is avascular necrosis, which sounds pretty bad, and it is. Basically what happens is that, you know, we talked about the blood supply comes from here and drifts all the way back here. This little bone is deprived of its blood supply for long enough, it'll just die. And so on the x-ray, you'll see the bone will have a whiter appearance. On an MRI, you see all these kind of whitish appearing bones. This part of the bone here is black. That's what's called AVN. And so here, if you have AVN, when you see a kid, that healing rate drops to 50% or below, off of that, no matter where the fracture is. And in my mind, treatment needs to somehow try to help restore the blood supply and bring life back to the bone. So that's where vascularized bone graft comes in. It's a fairly new technique within the last 10 years or so. It's used for non-union use, especially when there's AVN present. It can really improve your rates of healing, which are still pretty terrible, but it does make it somewhat better. Basically, what you're doing is taking the bone with its blood vessel attached and then hooking it in to where that fracture is not healing. You still fix it with the screw. I have these for a minimum of 6 weeks. These are, go much, much more slowly than these. I always use a bone stimulator in these as well. So here's just kind of a couple of clinical photos of what this looks like. It's a little hard to tell, but basically, here's a portion of the radius, the distal radius, and this is its blood supply. You can see where the vessel actually attaches and sits onto the bone. Here's the scaphoid exposed, and here's the non-union site, this area, and here this gap, and here that you're going to fill in with the bone, with its blood supply attached. So you take this little piece of bone with this tiny little blood vessel, and you swing it around and hook it in here, and that actually adds some, the thought is that it adds some blood back to the bone. So just to summarize, be vigilant about getting the athletes evaluated for wrist pain after a fall. Because these can be very difficult to diagnose. They can take some time to diagnose. And they can also take months and months to heal. Again, surgery and casting have overall similar healing rates for the non-displaced fractures, but it's a quicker return to sport with surgery. So most of the athletes that I see with the, even if it's a non-displaced fracture, a lot of them are opting. Well, thank you guys so much again for having me back. I appreciate it.
So, what's up, y'all? Welcome to the Sports Medicine Broadcast. This is with Dr. Candace Tunis and Stephen Luchesson.
Ramirez.
And I'm joined with Stephen Ramirez. Leslie's been joining me. So, we're here to talk about specifically scaphoid fractures and repair and those kind of things. And Dr. Tunis actually has to leave after her little session, the breakout session, so you can repair one today, right?
Yes.
How appropriate. Yeah.
All right. So, give me a quick who you are, what you do.
Sure. Again, I'm Candace Tunis. I'm a hand surgeon with Richmond Bone and Joint. So I treat hand, wrist, and elbow injuries and issues in kids all the way up to grandparents, too. So.
All right. So hand, wrist, elbow specialist. I remember last year you talked at the Memorial Hermann, this thing last year.
Yeah, I think it might have been 2 years ago. Time flies. Yes, I talked when it was down at MedMaid, and I talked just kind of an overview about hand and wrist fractures, just athletic injuries of the hand and wrist as well.
Yeah, and I know I tried to contact you, and I talked to Bubba, and at that point he said you weren't one of his doctors or something. I don't know, because I really wanted to talk to you on the podcast, because the way that you just explained things in the session then, and then in the breakout session, like, it really helped me understand. Because I feel that, like, the hand is something that we don't do a very good job of understanding. You know, as athletic trainers, it's pretty intricate. And then, you know, today you're talking about scaphoid fractures and how important it is to get that seen. And so, you know, that's obviously a big scare. Is kids fall all the time.
Yeah.
And one of the big things I heard you say more than once today was that, you know, after a big fall, and if a kid has wrist pain, then you should get them checked out.
So my question is, how do I determine whether I need to send a kid to get, do I need to send every kid to Falls to get checked out, or?
Yeah, I think that's a tough question. I think that's sort of the issue with these, because, I mean, falls happen all the time, and I've sprained my wrist, and I've broken my wrist, and, you know, they both felt exactly the same, and so it's very hard to tell the difference. I think in general, if something's lingering on, those are in particular. I mean, if it's a bad fall and they've got swelling and they've got real point tenderness, you know, again, we'll, you know, in the snuff box, which we will, you know, we'll talk about a little bit more what that is and how to examine it. But if they've got tenderness and swelling and real limited motion, I think those kids should get evaluated right away. The one that's kind of like, you know, kind of fell and, oh, it kind of hurts, I think you can give those a couple days or a week to kind of get better. And a lot of times, you know, I'll see them, you know, people who are being vigilant will send them to me right away. And, you know, the whole thing just hurts. And you can't even tell, like, where they're painful. You know, it's tender on this side, it's tender on that side, the whole thing. And, you know, and the x-rays are totally normal. And that's just a bad bruise or a sprain. And you know, those, though, will get fairly dramatically better. At least most of them will within about a week. So I'll see them all on like a Friday. My Friday afternoon clinic in Richmond that's all I see. So, you know, they fell Thursday night's practice. Can I play that weekend? You know? And so, you know, if there's nothing concerning on the x-ray, they're just tender everywhere. I mean, I'll protect them for comfort reasons, you know, but I think those I'll re-x-ray or re-examine in, you know, in a week or two. So it's kind of a convoluted answer to your question, but essentially, if they're just sort of tender everywhere, it's hard to localize and it, you know, it's kind of sore. I mean, you can wait and see if, as the dust settles, if that gets better. If they have swelling, visible bruising, and a lot of tenderness really over the scaphoid, I'd get them evaluated within the week. I don't know that you need to pull them out or something like that, but the problem happens is, in, you know, they fall and they have an injury in September and it's November and it's still sore. Yeah. And then they're going to, you know, those are the ones that I see again in December or January after they're done with all their, you know, playoffs and this and that. And then I come in and it's a 3-month-old fracture. And that's the issue, is that you'd like to get them within a few weeks if you can. And it's hard to do that. And the thing is that I think a lot of times it's really coming from the kids. It's not that the trainers are deliberately missing these. It's that the kid doesn't want to get taken out. You know, the kid wants to play, especially senior year, wants to play the rest of the season. You know, I did my fellowship in San Antonio with Dr. Green, and, you know, a lot of times if he saw them mid-season and it was already kind of a fracture that wasn't healing, and especially with a senior last year playing, he'd say, go ahead, finish out the season, and we'll fix it at the end. It's the same surgery then as it is in the middle of the season. Now, for an, you know, that's kind of gutsy to do that, and I don't know that I would have the guts to do that. But, you know, if it were an acute fracture, no, I'm going to fix that, because it's a whole lot easier to do it the first time around than to wait for it to not heal and then fix it.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting when you said, like, 40% of them, close to 40% are missed initially. And just, it's mind-blowing.
Yeah.
I mean, you think that volume and that rate, I mean, that's just crazy.
Well, and it's a couple of issues, you know. It's the lack of significant symptoms, you know.
Exactly.
And so it's, sometimes it's not how bad they hurt, but it's how long they hurt. Okay, you know, gosh, this thing is not getting better. And these usually kids are fairly tough, you know, and they want to play and they don't want to complain.
Yeah.
So, you know, if it's this is lingering, nagging pain, you know, and then you get into the issue of the x-rays look totally normal.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
That's the issue from our side of it, is that we'll look at it and be like, so pretty good, you know. And so that's where I think MRI is helpful. Some people talk about using CT scans, because they're certainly quicker and cheaper. The issue is you can get a false positive rate. And so I don't use them. I use CTs to evaluate if they're healing. I use MRIs to evaluate if they exist.
Yeah, that's crazy. Sounds like it's not really a lack of education, you know, on the athletic side at all. It's mostly, it's just hard to diagnose.
Yeah.
It's hard to see.
Yeah.
You know, and
you really have to, like, really look for them. And I think the only way you were going to get them all is if you sent everybody with wrist pain to get evaluated.
Yeah.
I think that's probably excessive.
Yeah, exactly.
You know? So,
and then, like you were saying, if we send them and the x-ray looks good, they may just go to the, you know, local emergency room. Oh, yeah, there's nothing broken.
Well, and that's the other thing, is that a lot of times they'll just go to the urgent care or whatever, and they'll say, okay, no fracture, go ahead and go back. And then You know, and it takes somebody really looking at these x-rays, and then you got to get the right x-rays. Yeah. I mean, I didn't go into this because it's not, you know, we could talk for 45 minutes about scaphoid fractures, but just a basic wrist series a lot of times doesn't catch them.
Yeah.
You have to do this special view where you do what's called ulnar deviated view, which brings your hand this way, and it brings, you know, this bone, I tell people, looks like a twisted peanut. It's like, it's about that size.
Yeah.
And so when you do it this way, it kind of brings more of the longest portion of the bone into view, and so it's a little easier to catch them doing that view, but a lot of people won't get that.
Yeah.
They'll just get a basic wrist series, and so some of it has to do with the quality of your x-rays, how much you're looking, and I've missed them. You know, I'm looking at an x-ray, and I'm like, that looks normal, and then I'll get an MRI because it's so concerned, you know, it looks so much like clinically like it should be a fracture, and then the MRI shows it, and I'm like,
maybe not. there's an issue.
So if a kid has a scaphoid fracture, and we tape them, would it diminish the pain or would it increase? Because usually if you press on a broken bone, it makes it hurt more.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if a kid comes in and I tape him and he's like, oh yeah, it feels better now, or it gives me enough support to play.
Mm-hmm.
That's the point where I'm not concerned about the fracture, or should I just continue to monitor?
I think you can continue to monitor that, you know. I think anything that kind of immobilizes it will tend to help this feel better. So I don't know for certain, but I would assume that taping probably would, because some of them aren't even really that point tender over it. They just hurt, you know, and the other thing is to watch the range of motion. If it really is painful when they move it, that's another thing that can be kind of a red flag. But I think that if taping really helps them a lot and they seem to be getting better, you know, if they get better to a point but they're still coming to get it taped, and it's been 2-3 weeks and they're still coming to get it taped, then, you know, if they haven't been evaluated already, I'd have to get it looked at.
So what are some of the, I know you showed some pictures of the surgeries, but what are some of the current trends in fixing scaphoid fractures?
So, I mean, again, for the middle of the bone non-displaced fracture, it's still somewhat debatable, and I always kind of go through the risks and benefits of surgery versus casting, you know, because you can still cast those. And, you know, I've got some that I'm casting right now because people really didn't want surgery, and that's fine. And they will heal at the same rate, again, around 85% to 90%, they'll heal. The nice thing about surgery is that surgery is putting a screw in the middle of the bone. It's acting like a cast from the inside. So you can kind of get them back doing stuff a little bit sooner than if you just casted them. You know, as far as studies that have been done and recent stuff, I guess that's probably the biggest takeaway point that I've gotten from literature, is that earlier return to sport with fixing it for those non-displaced fractures. So that's one thing. The other thing is a percutaneous approach. And it's kind of, you know, it's kind of sexy, it's kind of cool, you know, doing it through this little tiny incision. And I think a lot of hand surgeons will do it that way. Much, you know, less trauma to the area. The thing is to do that, to make sure that you're doing it well that way. And I think that's the issue. And I've treated a couple of percutaneous, you know, the kids that had it done percutaneously that didn't heal because it didn't adhere to good principles. You know, they fixed it from the wrong direction based on the fracture. So I think that it's a good, it's kind of neat, and it's a neat trick. I don't do it that way, but I think that's probably a fairly current trend is, you know, some hand surgeons are fixing it percutaneously. I do it through a small incision. I don't think it ends up making much of a difference, but I think percutaneous fixation is another kind of current trend. You know, bone stimulators is another kind of, you know, question mark, and I think they're being used a lot more aggressively because they, you know, they're getting, if insurance isn't paying for it, a lot of times the company will help out and donate it. In fact, I had a kid whose insurance switched and they weren't going to pay, the new insurance wasn't going to pay for the bone stimulator, and the company just gave it to him, you know. So there's definitely, you know, some, you know, aggressive marketing, if you will, from the bone stimulator companies. But I certainly don't think it can harm it, and I think it's a lot of times worth doing just to, again, and as I said in the talk, I throw sort of everything, including the kitchen sink, at some of these. I don't want to be back there. I've redone them, and it's, you know, they don't do as well. You want to do it right the first time. Mm-hmm. So that's why I tend to protect them a little longer and make sure that the screw is exactly where I want it, you know, and I give them a bone stimulator to start just to kind of get things going. And then I talked a little bit as far as, you know, this vascularized bone graft. That's you know, fairly newer technique, not being done, you know, everywhere. But it's kind of neat to be able to take a piece of bone. You know, everybody's heard of bone grafting. You know, you take a little bit of bone from your hip or whatever. That doesn't have any blood supply with it. It has lots of the goodies. It has a lot of the proteins and the structure of bone to help it heal, but it doesn't have existing blood supply. But because of the way that the anatomy of the blood supply is around the wrist, you can take a piece of bone with a little tiny blood vessel attached and then move it over and restore some blood supply. So that's kind of another.
So where do they take that piece of bone from?
The distal radius, so right about in here, sort of in between these. Paratendons here, you take it. There's lots of different options for where you can take it, but for scaphoids, this is the closest. So you take it here, and then it's swung on a vessel that's smaller than that hair tie, and you plug it into the bone there, and then you fix it with a screw.
That's amazing, just some of the advancements that we have. You know, we talked about looking at Dr. Gradia, mm-hmm. we talked about the advancements in the ACL, it's something even more specialized and localized right there, you know, in the hand of the wrist. It's really cool.
Yeah, it's fun. I mean, that's part of the reason why I really
Yeah, you've got a really cool, really specialized you know, down to your hand. I mean, you use it for everything.
Even your non-dominant hand, you don't realize how poorly you can't use it.
It's so frustrating. Absolutely. Yeah, I guess some of the recovery times, too. You know,
mm-hmm. And that's probably another thing where, as trainers, you'll see a lot of variability. And some of that is surgeon dependent, and some of that is dependent on the fracture, and some of it's dependent on the kid, you know. I'm again fairly conservative. I don't want to, you know, I've seen these things look great and then turn and look bad. You know, for the first 6 weeks, I'd be really hard pressed to let a kid play a contact sport within the first 6 weeks. Wow. But some will let them go at like 3 or 4, you know, with the screw in. So. Again, that's definitely you're going to run into different things. Yeah. There's not really a set out sort of recommendation. I think Dr. Hildreth and I treat somewhat similarly. Mm-hmm. I think we'll tend to, around the 6 week mark, if things are looking good, let them play protective. But if it were in a a non-teenager patient, a lot of them miss limb right away. Yeah. And a lot of times I'll do that, but teenagers, they're going to play.
Yeah, exactly.
So just cast them.
are you adhering to your splint? You know, are you wearing
exactly.
it? Oh, yeah, I'm wearing it. And then, you see, where's your splint? You don't have one, you know? It's crazy. Yeah, it takes that, you know, mm-hmm. that total buy-in to get back to your normal, or what you would perceive to be your normal state.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, these just take a long time. And, no matter how you, I tell people, no matter really how you treat it, the bone probably still take 4 to 5 months. Mm-hmm. The thing is that the screw allows you, you know, because it gives you that extra protection. Yeah. You know, cast is all you got in the cast, but the screw gives you that added protection to allow some, at least mobility. Mm-hmm. Does it allow contact, unprotected contact right away?
Probably not.
No, protected contact is somewhat debatable in that first 6 week mark.
So can we go back to the bone graft? I guess I'm just not an anyway expert in bone grafting because that's not something I do. But so they take a little piece of the bone off, but I would think that it would have to be similar in shape. So do they take a piece of the scaphoid out and put that new piece in there, and then it kind of grows into that shape, or do they shape that bone to fit? How does that?
Kind of yes to both of those. Right.
You nailed it.
So the times where I'm using a vascularized bone graft, or I see a kid and it's January, and he probably heard this thing in September. So it's 4 or 5 months, and I get an X-ray and very clearly see this non-healed scaphoid. In those kids, I'll get an MRI because I want to know, is that proximal fragment, that piece that's now been deprived of blood supply for 4 or 5 months, is it still alive? The MRI shows that it's still alive. A lot of times what I'll do is I'll just fix it, or I'll fix it and do just a little bit of what's called cancellous bone graft. It basically means you either take it from, you can take it from the wrist or you can take it from the hip. It's just you sort of scrape out the innards of that bone and just sort of pack it in, and it's loose and it doesn't have any blood supply. It takes 5-10 minutes to do. If however, the MRI shows that there's issues with the blood supply of that proximal piece, then I'll do a vascularized bone graft, which basically means, so I'll open it up from the back, I'll clean out the area, because you can see very clearly where this thing is not healing, and then you'll have a gap, usually, of, you know, where it's tried to heal, but it's not. And so, basically, you're using this little piece of bone to fill that gap. So, you're not really taking out a piece of the scaphoid, although sometimes you do have to in order to set the thing in right, to have to kind of whittle a little piece out. I mean, the piece that you're talking about is smaller than, it's about the size of your pinky nail, if that.
Wow.
So it's really pretty tiny. And then you you use osteotomes, which are glorified chisels, to take out basically the hard outer portion of this bone. And again, you have this, you can see the vessel that's sitting on top, and it's giving its blood supply through that harder outer portion. And so you take that little, that hard outer portion with the blood vessel attached, and you put it into that little kind of space that you've, that's there initially, and then you've also kind of whittled it out to make it fit properly. And then you got to trim that existing one, because inevitably you take too big of a piece, and you got to kind of like, you know, whittle it around and futz for a while until it fits right, and then you push it in, and it's kind of a press fit to kind of push it on the top. And now, rather than giving blood supply to the bone back here, now that vessel is giving blood supply into the scaphoid itself.
Mm-hmm. So you maintain the blood vessel and just stretch it, just stretch it up?
Yeah, you have to kind of release it. And you're able to do this because of a lot of interconnections between the vessels. Mm-hmm. You know, ordinarily in somewhere you take a blood vessel out and, you know, it's not going to work anymore. But you're getting another kind of flow through another part of the wrist, because it's like a big circuit. And
I
so... the Mayo Clinic did all these studies about the anatomy, and so there's like four or five different areas you can take this vascularized bone graft and use it for different things in the wrist. And it's, you know, I think it's really cool, which is why I mentioned it, even though it's kind of you know, maybe not something that necessarily need to know how you do it exactly, but it's kind of, I think, something
that's that is really
cool. I'd like to see it done.
Just hearing that kind of stuff. That's really cool.
Amazing. Yeah, there's another issue in the wrist that happens where the lunate, you know, there's another bone that can actually just die for reasons that we don't understand. That's a common reason why I'll use this. I'll use a different graft. I use one that's kind of over in a different portion of the wrist, but it's another reason why I will use a vascularized bone graft in the wrist.
Wow.
Very cool. And Jasmine over here, actually, it's pathetic, but I didn't know all the names of the bones of the wrist.
Mm-hmm.
Which is,
that's okay. No.
And it was like 2 months ago, she went to work a volleyball tournament with me, and so she knew them, and so she was quizzing me on them the whole time.
Did you learn the little fun memory trick?
Which one? Refresh our memory.
This
is maybe borderline podcast.
It's okay, Varro was on here earlier.
Yeah, Mike Varro is talking.
It's true. Okay, so you know there's 8 little bones in the wrist, and so the little mnemonic is some lovers try positions that they can't handle. So the way it goes is, so some lovers, so you're talking about the proximal row first, so scaphoid, lunate, try positions, triquetrum, pisiform, and then you go back around, that they can't handle. So that they is trapezium and trapezoid, so you got to know which of the T's comes next, but can't handle is capitate and hamate.
Wow. Because I do get the capitate and lunate mixed up, but the rest of them I got pretty good. I just can't ever remember. Some lovers try positions that I can't get.
And it's in the two rows. Yeah. The lunate is named lunate for moon.
That's
so
pretty funny.
If you look on an x-ray, it really looks like a moon.
I think that's appropriate.
I don't know.
It's all good.
It helps us. Yeah. All right, well, we got to... That's
sure.
Yeah. Waiting on you, so,
that's a wrap, I guess.
Yeah.
Let's go ahead and end on that.
That's
a high
note. Awesome, guys.
I will. Thank you so much. And again, I really, really have been looking forward to speaking to you. And maybe we can get you to come out sometime and speak again. So,
yeah, absolutely. I'm happy. I was happy to be invited back. I don't know why y'all skipped last year. Now it's cool. But no, I'm happy to come back anytime.